Hi, today is December 2nd, 2018. This is MoViews Podcast number 278. I'm Taru Gasawara, and the good Dr. Westfall is back from his super secret mission to begin year 11 of this podcast.
Yes, this is becoming a very enjoyable podcast for us to make. I just, you know, hopefully in this next year we'll have as many listeners as we have years of experience.
Exactly. And the other challenge coming up in this year, you know, sometime when Mac OS, not 10, I guess it's just Mac OS now. Sometime when the next version of Mac OS comes out, the app I use to level our volume levels is called Levelator. It's a free tool that that went out of support, 4 or 5 years ago, I think now, maybe more. But it still works fine. But at any rate, it's a 32-bit app, and the next version of macOS will not support 32-bit apps, so I need to go looking for something to do that. I think Audacity has a 64-bit version, or will, and I assume Audio Hijack, which is a commercial product, will be updated. But, yep, a little bit of a problem. I guess I haven't released a non-levelator volume leveled podcast in... Well, you know, like 10 years. So, actually, the first couple podcasts, I did not have it, and it was terrible. I had all kinds of problems in the beginning with, dealing with the stereo thing, and then I finally went to mono. That solved that. But in any case, I need to find a volume leveling tool sometime in the next couple of months. And I don't mind paying for it. I just... You know, this one is free, but I don't mind paying for it if it's, you know, not like hundreds of dollars or something.
Yeah, free is good, but I'm also of the opinion that if you have a decent software product,
yep,
there's nothing wrong with paying for it.
No, nope, not at all. Not at all.
I've purchased, in fact, in this era, it's sort of bizarre, but there are certain software products I would just like to be able to purchase.
Mm.
You know, certain apps on my phone that I really don't want to watch the ads or have the ads interrupt my experience. I would rather just be able to buy the thing outright. So,
right.
Sort of interesting how that's not even an option sometimes.
Yeah.
To buy the software.
Yeah, and you know, in more than one way. So it's not just a matter of, you know, free software that you'd like to support its existence, but also my favorite game, Sid Meier's Civilization for iOS, the first version, which was never updated, and it only runs under. It's a 32-bit app, so it only runs under OS 10. Nothing newer, not 11 or 12. And so, as you know, I have one of two iPad Pros that I simply keep it at iOS 10 so I can play my favorite game. But, yeah. Any rate, so here we are. I want to thank Paul Lawler for his two visits and Ricky Lee for his one visit with both Paul and me last week while John was on his super-secret mission. But we're back for at least a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Before the holiday seasons hit, and the good doctor has yet more secret missions to accomplish. I think something has to do with it. I'm assuming it has to do with, like, holiday secret missions, but anyway. Okay.
Yes. So now I will reveal details as I'm at liberty.
Okay. So the first thing I wanted to mention is something I had a lot of interest in until I saw its price tag, and that's the Google Pixel Slate. Which is not an Android tablet. It's a Chromebook tablet that can run Android apps. The Verge has, I don't know if I call it scathing, but its title kind of gives it away. Google keeps failing to understand tablets. I guess that's scathing.
It's scathing, but accurate.
Yeah. But, you know, I wish there was a review, and I should go to about Chromebooks that, you know, Kevin Toffel runs to see what he has to say. And in fact, I did, but oddly enough, his podcast won't run on my Chromebook. I'll go mention that to him later. But
this is how Google suppresses what it doesn't want you to see.
But what I'd like to, you know, see is a kind of a two-part review or two-pronged review of the Pixel Slate. One, just reviewing it as a Chromebook, disregarding the tablet aspect. I mean, yes, you can mention it, but how is it as a Chromebook, you know, a fairly expensive Chromebook? Mm-hmm. And that is because I think, you know, I use a Chromebook every day. That is my go-to notebook at home these days. The only time I fire up the Mac is for podcasts, and I can't remember the last time I fired up a Windows computer of any kind at home. At work, it's every day. But at home, it simply doesn't happen. And of course, with the 1809 update fiasco, I don't want to accidentally update my PCs and have files disappear or audio drivers disappear or whatever. Or not disappear, but not work. Anyway, so and the B, I'd like to see, then, after that, okay, review the Pixel Slate as a tablet, that can run Android apps. You don't have to, but you can. As you can with most Chromebooks, including mine. I have a Samsung Chromebook Plus, which I really, really like. It's about a year and a half old now. So anyway, I need to go look for other reviews. I'm not going to buy one. I'm just trying to understand, why we're getting such a mixed review of the Pixel Slate. I thought it was going to be great because, I like Chromebooks. And this looked like a great Chromebook. It's got, options for fast processors. And it's just too darn expensive. It's well over $1,000 for the configuration I'd like. And I can go buy a MacBook for that much. Yeah. The next thing is not expensive. And that is something I've been looking for several years. So a couple of years ago, back when the iPhone 4 came out, I think, I bought a really nice car mount for it. A little clamp thing. That was very, very, very nicely designed and firm and, it didn't rattle or anything like that. It was great. The problem with it was very specific to the phone model and case you had on. So, it had different clamps that for a phone without a case and another one for that same phone with a case. And then if you change phones, then you needed yet another mount for it. And it got kind of expensive after a while. So, and when Lightning came out, when the 30-pin connector was in use, it worked great. It held the 30-pin. The 30-pin connector was built in. There was kind of a little adapter attachment. And so you could quick release the phone and all that. With Lightning, it was the exact opposite. The Lightning portion of the mount kept breaking on me. The manufacturer replaced it, but after, one or two replacements, I said, oh, the heck with it. And I haven't used a... Let's see, when did Lightning come out? iPhone 5, I think? Maybe 6?
Yeah, it was the 5.
So I haven't had a mount in my car for my phone, any phone, for several years now. Since then, I'm now on iPhone 10. I should also note I had a separate mount because it kind of... That did slip in and out. So there's a piece that kind of embedded itself in your car inside of the air vent. And you had to use a tool that was very sturdy. But it meant, it couldn't be taken out and stuff. And, you had to spend basically $30 to $50 for every phone model you had to replace the mount portion of the device. Anyway, I gave up on that. On Black Friday, I found this thing called a Toros, T-O-R-R-A-S, cell phone holder for car, auto-clamping air vent mount holder cradle. And it was, I think it was like $10 during Black Friday. It's currently $16. And by golly, it's pretty darn good. I was really surprised. I figured for $10, if I didn't like it, well, you could either try to return it or just kind of put in my junk box. But it actually works pretty good. So the way it works is it has a little clamp that, you click down to. It's a positive lock clamp that you put in your air vent, and it locks onto one of the air vent plastic pieces. And I'm a little worried about breaking it, but so far, it looks okay. And the other neat thing is it kind of doesn't care what size your phone is or whether or not you have a case on. Because what happens is, as you drop it into the cradle, the bottom of the cradle pushes down. And that automatically adjusts the side pieces of the cradle to clamp onto your phone to make it, nice and firm, nice and snug. So it won't fall out and all that kind of stuff. And it works for $10 or $16 regular price. It works very well. And it doesn't seem to care that I have a Lightning thing. Basically, there's just a little hole in the bottom of it. And I haven't tried my Pixel 2, but I'm sure it'll work just as well. Sometimes it rattles a little because, it's not as securely mounted as my other cradle mount was. But gee, for $10, I'm not really complaining. The other nice thing is because it has a positive lock that you can lock and unlock onto the air vent, you can actually easily take off the entire thing. It's one piece. You can take it, and if you're traveling, you can go ahead and take this cradle with you and use it in a rental car. So you can you know, see your screen for maps and that sort of thing. So, anyway, TORRAS, cell phone holder for the car. I'll go put a link to it in Amazon on the show notes later. I was really happy. It's probably the best thing I've bought in the last couple of months. Let's see. Next up is something I don't know if I'm going to get, but I read on 9to5 Google that Google is starting to roll out call screening to Pixel owners. I'm not sure if they mean Pixel 3 only or if it's going to eventually roll out to the Pixel 2, which is what I have. But I'm really looking forward to it. So this is the other end of the Google Duplex feature. So instead of your phone calling out to, say, a restaurant to make a reservation on your behalf, this answers the call. You know, you say, well, what's the big deal about it? Okay, but hang on. It answers the call, incoming calls, tells them that it's an automated bot responding for the phone's owner, asks what the person wants, and if it needs more information or didn't understand, it will ask for more information and let the person know that, you know, if the person chooses to, you'll return the call. But anyway, I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm hoping I can customize it with, you know, swear words for robocallers.
Certain people get a more colorful version of Todd's.
Yeah. I sort of doubt it. I'd be just happy to get it. And so I don't know exactly when it's going to come or if it's going to come for my Pixel 2, but I'm certainly looking forward to it.
It's funny. You talk about just wanting, you know, the feature. Over the last couple of weeks, we've been getting a new phone system at work. And this is upgrading a 40-year-old phone system to a voice over IP-based system.
Yeah.
And so I went into my office this morning and I saw my new phone sitting on my desk. They had installed it over on Friday afternoon when I wasn't in. And I sat there for like 5 minutes going, this is a really cheap voice over IP system, but it's still 10 times better than what we had.
Okay. Well, that's good. So you're happy with it.
Yeah. I mean, I've done enough voice over IP work in the past where, you know, I'm like, yep, it's the bare bones. It's nothing fancy, but man, it's 10,000 times better because, you know, revolutionary features like caller ID we now have.
Oh, so. Wow. Wow, so modern.
I know.
You're like in 1992.
Built-in speakerphones and things like that. It's just a crazy, crazy thing. So. But yeah, that's the... It's sort of the irony when you've been living in the past, but I do like the idea of the mount that you were talking about going back a couple of stories, the idea of something cheap and useful. I like the idea of Pixel owners having automated call screening, and I'm still just amazed that Google and nobody else other than Apple can really create a tablet. It just seems like there's no good way to make a tablet other than – I think what honestly it is – and I was thinking about this as I was thinking about our show notes today. It's that nobody wants to copy the iPad, but in many iterations of trying, maybe that's the only type of tablet interface and design that really works before someone says, you know what, this is just a regular computer.
Yeah.
So I think that's definitely what it is with the Surface tablets. You know, they're – too good in a sense to just be a tablet, so everyone uses them as laptops.
Yeah, like I do. And you.
I never see anyone walking around with their Surface tablet, you know, holding it as a tablet. It's always, oh, let me set it up, put it on this table, and use the keyboard. So,
absolutely.
Maybe there is only one way to do a tablet right now, and Apple figured that way out.
Yeah, and you know, the problem, I think, well, for some people, you know, like I said, I use a Chromebook every day and I like it. But if you want to use it as a tablet with Android apps, the problem is Android apps are not designed for tablets at all, period. That's why Android tablets died, because all the apps for it were terrible, or at least not designed for it. They're designed for phones, you know, so for smaller screens, and tap surfaces are, you know, not appropriate for a larger display, and larger being 8 inches or more. Although I guess we're going to see an 8-inch phone pretty soon. But yeah, it's you know, I still really want to like the Pixel Slate. And if it were, like I said, if it were less expensive, I would buy one. This Pixelbook, and I shouldn't say that, I'm running on a MacBook right now, but the Chromebook I use is going to age out pretty soon, where it won't be able to get any more Chromebook OS updates. I think it's 2 or 3 years. So I'm going to be looking for a new Chromebook pretty soon. It probably won't be a Google one, unfortunately, because it's just too expensive. But there are other manufacturers who make, you know, comparable devices, and I'll be looking to them. Probably in the next 6 to 12 months to replace my current Chromebook. Only because I'd like to get the latest and greatest features going forward. Mm-hmm. Okay, more Googly news. Google Project Fi, and I'm a Project Fi user on my Pixel 2. They're my MVNO, mobile virtual network operator.
Yes.
They're my MVNO, and so I use them for my phone. They were called Project Fi until last week, and now they're simply Google Fi. And they work with iPhones. And in fact, I think my coworker activated his iPhone as on Project Fi. Although it's kind of weird, so because he got the Google Fi micro SIM or whatever it's called these days for his iPhone, but you need a Project Fi phone to activate it, so you can't. So he borrowed my phone, and my Pixel 2. So my Pixel 2 has an eSIM, so it doesn't actually have a card. So my SIM slot was empty, and so we just stuck it in there, and we activated it and handed it back to him. Didn't have to reactivate my phone because it deactivated my Fi network on my phone, but that just took a few minutes. Although I didn't notice it first since I'd never done that. And I think it's missing a few things, like maybe it doesn't roam to certain networks, but, you know, if you've got an iPhone and you want to use Project Fi, there you go, but you're going to need somebody with a Project Fi phone handy to activate your SIM card. I've really enjoyed using Project Fi or Google Fi. So it uses T-Mobile and Sprint, which are both available where I live, and also a third one, US Cellular, which is not available in Hawaii. So I don't think I've ever roamed on US Cellular. And when I was traveling with my Fi phones, I think US Cellular was not yet a provider, so I've never been on their network. Okay. Next googly thing is Google Assistant. The weather data is still wonky for my area. And I noticed when looking on the Google Assist or the Lenovo smart display, Google Assistant is using weather data from weather.com, which is, you know, respectable and presumably reliable service for many, many years. So I'm, you know, not sure why it's so far off. And not only is it off, it's contradicting its own information. So, let's do a demo and I'll explain. I already showed John this. Let me get the volume up so other folks can hear it. Okay, Google, volume 8. Okay, Google, weather?
Currently in Honolulu, it's 74 and partly cloudy. Today, it'll be partly cloudy with a forecasted high of 75 and a low of 68.
Okay, so there's all kinds of things wrong with that. First, it's not 75 degrees. It's about 78.
We're
going to
start with, I'm not in Honolulu.
Yeah. Next it says the forecasted high is 76, but clearly on the screen it says the forecasted high is 76, 1 degree higher. And in fact, earlier I showed John a photo of the screen that I took where it said the forecast high was 74 and it's clearly showing 77 as a forecasted high on the display. So not only is the temperature not accurate, but its own forecasted highs are in... like I said, contradict what it's showing on the display. So I don't know what's going on. But in general, I found that Amazon Echo's weather source is more accurate. I don't know who they're using, though, but it is weather.com that Google is using. I guess I'll tweet to them and say what's going on. I assume they're using a weather station that's up a little high where it's cooler or something like that, because it's never been correct, ever. It's always about 5 degrees off, which to me is a lot when it's warm like this. Okay, next up... Oh, this was... I thought you might find this interesting, John.
Okay.
I read that Corel, you know, the people who did WordPerfect and those kind of things, they're buying Parallels, which I think you use. I know I do.
I use VirtualBox.
Oh, okay. Well, I use...
Because I'm just cheap.
Yeah. VirtualBox is free. I used Parallels because I put it in my daughter's MacBook Air, actually, because I thought she might need support beyond what I could provide if something happened, so...
Okay.
I got her Parallels to run Windows 10. But this is the surprise to me. Not that Corel bought Parallels, but Corel is still around. I thought they'd disappear. So.
Well, I don't know their history, but they seem like, it seems like this did happen, or maybe just happened in my dreams, or it seems like it's something that should have happened. I thought at some point they were bought out, then
yeah.
they went away, and then they were spun back out.
Oh, is that what happened?
As Pharrell again.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't remember for sure. And like I said, if that's not what happened, that seems like what should have happened.
No, you got at least part of that I know is correct, because I did see that they do have a parent, Corel has a parent company. And so, you know, somebody owns mm-hmm. Corel, and Corel bought Parallels. What I don't understand is why Corel bought Parallels. I guess I'm not surprised somebody bought Parallels, but why Corel? You know, because they do, like, productivity apps. They do have Corel Draw someone, and WordPerfect someone, and things like that.
Someone lost a bet.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah. You know, a game of poker one day that just someone got the wrong, you know, cards, and they had to buy Corel. It was on the table.
Yeah.
My thoughts on Corel are just, it'd be nice to actually, you know, here is the interesting thing about it. Wouldn't it be nice to actually have options in Word, like in Office programming again?
In suites? Yeah.
Because right now you just have Microsoft Office, which probably has a ludicrously high market share if you were to look it up.
Yep.
And Google Apps. But unless you, if you don't want the whole apps ecosystem, you could go with OpenOffice. But OpenOffice doesn't have that much in terms of support and wide availability. So I kind of miss the days when there were competing Office suites and some people had better features than others. And
yeah.
it kind of pushed the whole group. Because, you know, you haven't seen a lot of innovation in Microsoft Office capabilities in the last 10
yeah.
years.
Well, there are other office suites. It's just none of them have even 1% market share. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, WordPerfect is still out there, and OpenOffice. Actually, there's a fork, an open source fork of it called LibreOffice, free office that's out there. I've installed it, by the way. I tried using it as my office suite on Windows a number of years ago, but it was just, there are enough compatibility issues that I just couldn't use it, and I had to, you know, go back to regular Office. But you know what I really miss? I miss, hey. I think, yeah, it was Borland. Remember Borland, the Turbo Pascal folks? Borland
yes.
had a spreadsheet called Quattro Pro, which
oh, yeah.
I really liked. I mean, I still think it's better than Excel. You know, I don't remember why I thought that, but I remember thinking, wow, this is way better than Excel. And it was, you know, reasonably priced and easy to use and super fast, and I really miss the Borland Turbo Pascal. I mean, Turbo Quattro Pro, but that's it. Okay. Anyway, so John, what have you been up to? Looks like you've got a few things.
Yeah, I added a few things on, and some of these, you asked me, we started off before this asking, you know, if I did any Black Friday shopping.
Right, right.
And I said that basically my Black Friday shopping is the geekiest of Black Friday shopping anyone could ever do. And by that I mean I have subscribed to a website for newsletters called Low End Talk or Low End Box. There's basically Low End Talk is the support forums. It's lowendbox.com is where it's based. And these are this is basically groups that do bargain basement VPN, or not VPN, but VPS, virtual private servers and web hosting. And the idea here is if you know what you're doing, they're quite happy to sell you a virtual private server with very little bells and whistles. No one, you know, you can't call them up and say, hey, I can't get my web server running. They're going to tell you, well, that's your job to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of companies are running some really good deals. And I have all my virtual servers typically at one company. But I thought, well, you know, for redundancy, it wouldn't be bad to have one at another company in another data center in another part of the country. And so I picked up a couple of deals. One was a $45 per year, 1 terabyte storage server.
Hmm.
So that's going to be where I make backups to OneDrive because I have the 1 terabyte OneDrive. So I've been using that. But this is just another redundant set of backup files, a completely different set. So it's nice to have those stored in a different data center. And then a $10 per year, 2 gigabyte Linux server that's basically my hot spare server sitting there in case my primary servers go down or that company, you know, closes shop and I have to rebuild somewhere else. So it's sort of nice to have that redundancy. But as I said, it is an extremely geeky sort of thing to buy as your Black Friday deal.
So I see that. I guess the one you are using is the Calibri Web via Docker.
Well, that's something else. That's my something second else? Something okay. else to check out, which I'll talk about in a minute.
Okay.
But I can put in, if anyone's interested in the website that I'm talking about, it's just lowendbox.com.
And okay.
You go there, it's basically a good news feed for bare minimum VPSs, dedicated servers, hosting packages. So if you know what you're doing, check that website out to know when these per year, costs, $10 per year, $12 per year. I think my whole server infrastructure is less than $100 per year, and I have three or four boxes that are just spares.
Wow.
So
that's pretty good.
I'm taking a look if you are a sysadmin just looking for something basic that you can set up shop in.
Yeah.
I don't know, Todd. You might not have as much paranoia as me for your personal backups, but I've got backups upon backups everywhere.
I'm fairly paranoid, but not as much as you, I have to admit.
I have an at-home network attached storage that replicates to an at-work network attached storage, which replicates to other places, which... I don't know what I'm storing that's so important, but I've got it. So if anyone has data that you worked long and hard on that you want to save, send it to me and I'll throw it on my 800 distributed backups and no one will ever lose it.
So you are prepared for the zombie apocalypse.
I am, because the zombies are really going to want to know about my class prep files from 7 years ago or something like that. The other thing that I thought would be fun to check out, if anyone's interested in it, I spent some time over the last few days modernizing my ebook library. So if you're like me and like reading, you might have a collection of ebooks that doesn't just live in one cloud. You maybe have some Kindle books, you maybe have just some EPUB files for open textbooks that you have, or public domain books that the classics, those sorts of things. There is a well-known piece of open-source software called Calibre.
Oh, Calibre.
That I believe it's pronounced Calibre.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I was thinking Libre and Calibre.
Calibre runs on Windows, Mac OS, or Linux, and it has a little built-in web server, but it's not that great of a web server. But there's a fork of it called Calibre Web that you can basically get up and running, and I use Docker for this. Docker is basically, these self-contained little containers that you have that run a piece of software. So I have a Calibre Web Docker instance that runs on my home network that shares out my 3,500 ebooks so nice. That I can – it's basically a little private library. I can log in. I can hit a button and it will transcode like an EPUB to Amazon Mobi format and send it to my Kindle. So if you've never thought about it, you just have a giant directory somewhere of ebook files and you think, I wish I had somewhere nice that I could access these from, check that out. We'll put a link in the show notes for Calibre Web. And if you are an audiobook fan, the Plex software that people use for at-home media streaming can support music files, and there is a way now to have it set up for audiobooks. There's actually a metadata scraper that'll scrape Audible for the metadata for your audiobooks. So if you've just got ripped audiobooks, maybe you bought CDs years ago or something like that, and you ripped the audio files off of them, you can now have that in Plex. And of course, the nice thing about Plex is you can have media for offline use. So if you're traveling this holiday and you want to put a whole audiobook on your phone, but it's your MP3 files and not through somewhere that has their own app, you could use Plex for that and get the same outcome.
It's funny, when you're talking about that, it brought to mind something. So if you have ebooks that you'd like to read and blah, blah, blah. I do, but I don't think I can read them. Do you remember back in the Windows, maybe the Pocket, maybe even the palm-sized PC days? Microsoft had a deal with Barnes & Noble to provide ebooks for the, palm-sized PC or whatever it was at the time. And I think they're DRM'd. Well, let me go back. And this is why I think thought you might remember, there were about a dozen free Star Trek novels. I mean, titles you would recognize. And so I downloaded all of them, never read all of them. I've read some of them in book form, but not in ebook form. But I think they're DRM'd and there's no way to actually read them anymore because, you know, Barnes & Noble and Puff and Windows, you know, palm-sized PC and Pocket PC went Puff. And
DRM'd content is some of my, just the bane of my existence because I understand the desire to not have rampant piracy. Yeah. I totally get that. But these services die. They just will. I mean, we've seen certain services have a very long life.
Yeah.
iTunes has been around for quite a long time now. Yep. But the idea that it will always, those activation servers will always be there and you will always be able to get those files, it's just not feasible.
Yeah.
And man, is it frustrating when you can't access content that you legally paid for.
Yep. And I was going to say, especially with Microsoft-provided content, I mean, how many times has Microsoft shut down one of its own content types or partner content providers or whatever? I remember when we were writing for Jason, our buddy Jason Dunn, who was the editor handling stuff for Microsoft's Microsoft.com Pocket PC stuff or whatever it was at the time, palm-sized PC stuff. I actually bought some music, you know, to write about, you know, the process of buying music. This is before iTunes, so it's quite a novel thing. Buying digital music and downloading it to the palm-sized PC and, you know, having a player, and it had activation. And, of course, the activator died in a couple of years. It died way, way, way before Windows CE / Windows Mobile died. And so I couldn't, and I, like you said, I couldn't access music I bought. So, well, thanks, Microsoft.
Hey, Microsoft is the one that had a DRM structure called Plays for Sure.
Oh, yeah, which doesn't play for at all.
Yeah, it doesn't play at all. If you are interested, if you have media, especially if you have ebook files, Caliber Web, if you have audiobook files, Plex, if you have any real files that you want to keep available and serving and have kind of a modern, all the benefits of the modern architectures, Plex is a great piece of software for that. And they do have a premium tier that costs a certain amount of money per year or per month, but they also have a lifetime membership you can buy, which is a chunk of change, but you then don't have monthly payments. Hmm. So again, you could just buy the software and have the service. And they'll probably be around at least for another 4 or 5 years before something gets bigger and better. So I figure if you jump in now, the lifetime will be worth it in terms of how many months you get out of it.
Yeah, nice. Now, your last item really surprises me, so I want you to explain this to me.
Well, you know, there is another podcast that I have not been on that you do called Comic Views.
Right.
And I did not grow up as a comic book fan.
Which you have told me many times.
I recently did create a Comixology account.
Why?
Because, I've never had anything against comic books.
Yeah.
So it's not like I, you know, read them and didn't like them. And
yeah.
It just is never something I got much into. But recently I found that there is some interesting comic crossovers that are published by Marvel, but are the Disney Parks series of graphic novels and comics that are actually, according to Disney, canon, because they own Marvel, backstories for some of the rides at Walt Disney World.
There are comic books about this?
Yes, there are. and I wanted to read those because I'm planning a trip to Disney World, and some of these are characters that never really got fleshed out in their rides. You know, these are just characters just sort of show up. And so I thought I would buy some of them, and I did. And especially with Comixology running so many sales over the last week, I've spent probably $30 or so on comic books.
About rides or characters?
Yeah, well, about characters in rides and in some cases rides. So, for example, one of them is in Epcot, the Disney theme park.
Right.
There is a pavilion called the Imagination Pavilion.
Yeah, it's a big one.
And inside Imagination, there is a ride that contains a character called Figment.
Huh.
Figment is this little purple dragon, and the ride never really explains how he comes to be or what he is. I mean, he's just sort of the embodiment of imagination. And there is now two series of comics on Figment and his backstory and the backstory of the person who created him. It's a steampunk fantasy story. I wanted to read it, and I enjoyed reading it. The artwork is excellent.
I got to look this up.
Line was interesting. I will put a link in our show notes, and you can go look at the Figment comics. And there's a comic series for the Enchanted Tiki Room. There's one for Big Thunder Mountain Railroad. There's one for Haunted Mansion. Yeah, so I bit the bullet and have a Comixology account and have been reading comic books, but I thought you would appreciate this.
I do, and I have to say, I've never heard of it. And I'm a fan of Disney theme parks, and I've been to, let me see, how many theme parks have I been to? Three, I guess. My daughter's been to four. I think she's been to four of them, but maybe five. But I've never heard of these. And, you know, you're a Star Trek fan, I know.
Mm-hmm.
As a Star Trek fan, you might be interested to know there are lots and lots of Star Trek comic books. And there are even Star Trek crossovers with my other favorite character, which I know not one of yours, but one of Doctor Who. The good mm-hmm. Doctor shows up with Picard in a couple of crossovers. But, okay, well, this may be the start of a new hobby for you.
It might be. I do enjoy reading of all kinds. So yeah. I plan on, once I read the books that I bought, going through and seeing if there's others that I would like to take a look at.
So. Right. And at the risk of, angering the Disney lawyers, maybe you'll be knitting some of these characters. I don't know.
You never know. There are knitted patterns for many Disney characters that use very generic names.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of an interesting, everyone knows what that character is.
But it's called Rodney Rodent instead.
Yeah, exactly. Rodney Rodent.
All right. Well, it's good to have you back, John, after your super secret mission for the last two weekends. And we'll be regrouping for another couple of weeks before the holidays hit us, and then we'll take a little hiatus probably. And we'll talk to you next time.